From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Just over 30 years ago, this was the scene in Tehran.
It was late morning in Tehran when the mob of students stormed the embassy. The small contingent of U.S. Marine guards, under orders to avoid violence, tried to disperse the crowd with tear gas, but was vastly outnumbered. The demonstrators
are holding hostages, one report says, as many as 100, most of them American, and are demanding that the exiled Shah of Iran, now undergoing cancer treatment at a New York hospital, be returned to stand trial.
The Iranian Revolution was an anti-American revolution. It was a protest by various sectors of Iranian society against what they saw as American dominance.
I would like to speak directly to the people and leaders of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Now, flash forward 30 years.
There are those who insist that we be defined by our differences. But let us remember the words that were written by the poet Sa'di so many years ago. The children of Adam are limbs to each other, having been created of one essence.
Today we'll take stock of Iran 30 years after the revolution, as we examine the country through music, film, and memoir. But first, perhaps the most famous target of the Ayatollah Khomeini, Salman Rushdie. His novel, The Satanic Verses, recently marked its own 20th anniversary. Of course, the book sparked a furor, leading to a series of bombings and assassinations around the world, and a fatwa calling for the death of Rushdie, which sent the author into hiding for nearly a decade. Salman Rushdie stopped by our studio to talk about the Satanic Verses with Steve Paulson.
Did you have any inkling that it was going to be so controversial when you were writing it?
Not really, no. I mean, I guess I made the assumption that people who live in free societies make, which is the assumption of freedom. You know, I mean, I assumed that I could write about anything I felt like. That's, I think, what every writer in a free society assumes. Otherwise, you don't know how to start. I guess I thought that those relatively short passages of the novel, which deal with the kind of reinterpretation of the birth of a religion, might upset some conventionally conservatively religious Muslims. But I thought, you know, after all, in the novel, the religion is not called Islam, the prophet is not called Muhammad, the city is not called Makkah. And the whole thing, these so-called troublesome passages, take place in a dream sequence. And the dream is being dreamt by a man who is losing his mind. So, I mean, these are like 9 degrees of separation, you know. And it seemed to me that what I hoped people would understand is that the thing that was being attempted in those passages was not anything as crude as an attack or an insult, but an attempt to look at the nature of revelation, what it was. Yes, admittedly, from the point of view of somebody who was skeptical about it. And I thought that was a perfectly legitimate project. And if there were people who didn't like it, they didn't have to read it. You know, I mean, one of the reasons why there's more than one book in a bookstore is that people can choose the ones they want to read. That was my going-in position. So, no, I mean, not only did I not know it was going to happen, but nor did anyone else. In fact, my previous novels had been highly praised in Iran, I mean, post-Ayatollah Iran. And so nobody in Iran suspected there was going to be any trouble. And indeed, bookstores in Iran, the one or two bookstores that existed which sold English language books, had imported large quantities of this novel to sell. And for 6 months, remember the novel came out in September 88, the fatwa, the attack on the novel, was in February 89. So there was a period of 6 months when the book was being freely sold in Tehran without causing any problem at all.
So what do you think happened? I mean, why suddenly did it catch on and become this?
I think it's my misfortune to have been Khomeini's last stand. You know, I think Khomeini was having a very hard time. First of all, he was dying. Secondly, the revolution was in considerable trouble after his defeat in his Iraq war. And he was looking for a way of rallying the troops, and my bad luck is that I was it.
So it was sort of the perfect storm, in a way. I mean, this particular historical moment, the late 1980s, where your book landed on the scene.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, bad timing. I mean, had the book come out 6 months later when Khomeini had died, I don't think any of the things that we now know about would have happened.
Hmm. Now, more recently, we have seen other instances not as severe as what happened to you with the Satanic Verses, but of course there were the Danish cartoonists, mm-hmm. and which caused another enormous rupture of furor around the Muslim world. And yet it also seems that we're starting to hear a greater diversity of voices.
Yeah, I think finally, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, what would a respectful political cartoon look like? What would a reverential political cartoon do? It certainly wouldn't make you laugh. I mean, the nature of the form is to be irreverent and indeed rude. And so we either have to accept that we will have such things as political cartoons. And if so, we all have to develop, you know, a thick enough skin to deal with it. And there's just really no other way forward. But I do think it's encouraging now that there are many voices, even inside the Western Muslim community, certainly, who understand that this kind of overreaction is counterproductive and unhelpful to them. So, you know, for example, there was a production, German theater production, of a play based on the Satanic Verses in Potsdam near Berlin about 6 months ago. And of course, as usual, whenever anything with that book rears its head, people were worried about trouble. But what happened was that nothing happened. Mm-hmm. What happened is that the play came out and people liked it or didn't like it, and it finished its run, ended. And there were many Muslim voices in Germany at the time saying, do not overreact to this. Do not rise to it, if you like, you know. And I think it's good if that kind of sensibility is developing.
But on the other hand, do you think that novelists have learned their lesson when it comes to writing about the Prophet Muhammad or
sort
of
not.
Core principles of Islam, that it's
not.
Just best to stay
I mean,
away?
I think people are scared. There's no question that there's an atmosphere of fear. But I would hope that novelists have not learned their lesson. Novelists, actually, in my experience, are very bad at learning lessons. Obstinate creatures, novelists, you know, bloody-minded creatures. And without them, you know, the world would be a poorer place.
Salman Rushdie, talking with Steve Paulson. A new edition of the Satanic Verses was published on its 20th anniversary. Many things can evoke a memory, like a smell or a touch. When singer Mama Khaddam wanted to call up the memory of her native Iran in 1979, she did it with music. It all started when a friend in Tehran asked her to create the soundtrack for an art installation to mark the Iranian Revolution 30 years ago. The installation was an old photo of a baby in a bassinet with the hand of a mother rocking it. Khaddam immediately thought of lullabies, and then of songs of the revolution, songs from the left and the right that were sung in the streets. So she combined them, using lullaby tunes along with revolutionary song lyrics. The art installation with the music recently had a 10-day opening in Tehran. Mameh Haram sat down with Anne Strainchamps to talk about what she calls good night songs of the revolution.
Hello.
It's amazing because many of the Iranians have chosen to forget these songs, but they're all there. They're all in our minds. These are songs that, to some extent, you can say has awakened a generation and at the same time has put to sleep another generation.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu
In the art installation, you sang the songs, we hear your voice, but you sang them as lullabies.
The fact that the songs are sang by a woman is significant since women are not permitted to sing in public in Iran. So that was very important that I wanted to be that woman to sing the songs. Originally, these songs are very masculine. You hear mostly men on them. The second thing is that we wanted it to be with a different tone of voice, more or less like a mother singing to put her child to sleep. Softly, I wanted it to be sincere. I wanted it to be very simple.
قسم به اسم آزادی
These songs do represent the collective memory of Iranians during and after the revolution, and they have been burned in our memories from a very emotional time in our history.
You know, the whole time I was listening to these songs, I kept thinking about this. There's a line from a poem. You hear the line quoted a lot. Hardly anybody remembers the poem, but the line is, "The hand that rocks the cradle is the hand that rules the world."
That's fantastic, and that's the hand of a mother.
We should talk about the lyrics of the songs and what the actual words are. Some of them, they're really interesting in that a lot of the lyrics are about springtime. Except, so there are these images of flowers and trees budding, interspersed with other images of blood and guns. It's a really kind of chilling juxtaposition. But was
exactly.
Was it inspiring at the time?
Yes, it was. I think at the time it was very inspiring. I think that many people who sang these songs, they truly believed in the power of the words that are behind these songs. You know, I think people sang it with all their heart.
چو در جهان قیود بندگی اگر فتد به پای مردمی به دست توست به رأی مشت توست رهایی جهان ز طوق جور و ظلم به پا کنیم قیام مردمی رها شویم ز قید بندگی چو در جهان قیود بندگی اگر فتد به پای مردمی به دست توست به رأی مشت توست.
I don't know the lyrics, but the tune is from a chant. I've heard it dozens of protests in the West.
Yes, yes, bravo. It was done by this Chilean composer. And the words that you probably have heard in the streets of downtown LA in all the protests, and it goes like, El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. And I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, but this is what I've heard. And that is, the people united will never be defeated.
Could we end by asking you to sing a song for us? Something maybe that would take all Iranians back to 1979, back to the revolution?
Yes, I would like to do that. I chose a song that's called Happy Spring. It was a period of time that all the factions were aiming to create a utopia. And that was the first time and probably the last time that so many diverse groups united. And that's the significance of this song for me, that everybody sang it. It didn't matter if you were a leftist or a rightist or fundamentalist. Everybody sang this song. And in a way, I chose it for that purpose.
And what are the words?
The words are as follows. The air is fine. Flowers have sprung from the ground. The swallow returns to sing of hope. Blood is boiling in the veins of leaves. Happy spring. Spring comes with grace. To family, friends, and loved ones. To eagle-eyed men who fight for us. To those who ride on liberty. Happy spring. Happy spring. هوا دلپذیر شد گل از خاک بردمید پرستو به بازگشت زد نغمه امید به جوش آمد از خون درون رگ گیا بهار خجسته باز خرامان رسد زرا بهار خجسته باز خرامان رسد زرا به خیشان به دوستان به یاران آشنا به مردان تیز خشم که پیکار می کنند به آنان که با قلم تباهی دهر را به چشم جهانیان پدیدار می کنند بهاران خجسته باد بهاران خجسته باد بهاران خجسته باد.
That's Iranian singer Mamach Khadem. Her latest CD is called Just a Jew, Forever Seeking. Anne Strangeham spoke with her. Coming up, why it is so difficult to be a journalist in Iran. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Azadeh Moveni is a longtime Middle Eastern correspondent for Time magazine. An Iranian-American, she's fluent in Farsi and Arabic, and one of the few American correspondents who's worked continuously in Iran since 1999. She's also written two books about her experiences there. First, Lipstick Jihad, and now Honeymoon in Tehran. Steve Paulson spoke with Azadeh Moveni.
When you went back to Iran, one of the first people you looked up was the government minder you call Mr. X, a man who kept tabs on your work as a foreign journalist working in Iran. Why did you feel the need to get in touch with him?
Well, when Iranian journalists do have a minder, they are asked to stay in regular contact with, and it's always him. And so I knew that this was expected of me and that if I wanted to work, that I had to have his permission, in addition to the permission of the Ministry of Culture, which is, of course, officially in charge of foreign journalists. So I wanted to be safe and I wanted to be cautious and make sure that everyone in government who had anything to say about me working was in agreement.
And did he have a lot of power over you?
He certainly did. Iran is a government and a country with multiple centers of power. And sometimes as a journalist, it's bewildering to know all of the different institutions that have power over you. So he certainly would have had a veto right over my ability to work.
Now, the relationship that you describe with Mr. X is really pretty strange, how you would meet in out-of-the-way, slightly dangerous locations. And you say he behaved like a controlling husband. What made those encounters so menacing?
Well, first of all, it was creepy to meet in places that were so secluded, hotels that, for example, didn't even have an official sign outside marking what they were, always very secluded, far-off places where you would sort of... It was intentional, of course. I think these kind of places were chosen to make me or other journalists feel very vulnerable because you felt as though you were going into a place and no one really knew where you were. And if something were to happen, no one would really hear you or be able to find out what had become of you.
And did Mr. X know basically what you were up to from day to day? I mean, did he know who you were talking to and who you were hanging out with?
He certainly did, and he made it a point of conveying that. And much of this, I think, was through just my phone being tapped as well, because I didn't certainly tell him everything that he knew. He had much of it from other sources. And I think that was also part of the whole dynamic, was to make certain that I knew that I was being listened to.
This was your cell phone?
Probably my cell phone, my house phone. You know, in Iran, it's anyone who is engaged in anything considered sensitive by the government assumes that their phones are tapped. So no one in Iran will really sit down and have an open conversation on the phone if they're involved in anything the government considers dangerous.
And your relationship with Mr. X was pretty typical of all foreign journalists who were working there?
No, foreign journalists don't usually have this kind of relationship with a minder. They're not monitored in this way.
So you were not considered a foreign journalist then? You were considered an Iranian journalist?
That's how I was treated, because they would certainly never do this to a full-fledged American or a European working for an American or European publication. It's Iranian journalists have to go through this, and Iranian journalists who work for the Western media in this way are treated like Iranians, yes.
Even though you are an American citizen, I presume.
I am, but many of us, like me, have dual nationality. So we go into Iran on our Iranian passports, and so we are not treated as Americans or whatever else we might be when we're in the country.
Now, I have to say, when I read your book and when I've read other things about Iran, I have trouble figuring out who really has power. I mean, clearly the conservative clerics have a lot of power, but what I find puzzling is how that power is actually exercised in daily life, because it seems not exactly haphazard, but you can get into trouble, but you can also get away with a lot of stuff.
Iran is an opaque place. I mean, most of the things that people, especially young people, will do in the course of their daily life, whether it's listening to Western music or dating or all the things young people do, a lot of this is all technically illegal. Most of the time, these laws are not enforced. But Iran is very mercurial. You know, 1 month the government might crack down and young people or women will find themselves, you know, maybe being stopped on the street for what they're wearing, or there'll be a knock at the door and police will come to take your satellite dish away from the roof. But then there will be months and months where you can go ahead and do all of this. So it just, Iran is sort of a place where you can't quite predict when things are going to be enforced.
You said dating is illegal?
It is. It is in the proper sense. I mean, premarital sex is certainly illegal, and it is not permitted to be in the company of a man or a woman who's not your immediate relative. You can be stopped at a checkpoint, for example, you know, on a Friday evening, and if you're a young man or a young woman sitting in the car together and you can't prove that you're not immediate family, that can be something that's grounds for different kinds of punishment.
So this is all about what can be seen in public. I mean, there's a very sharp division between what you can do out among other people and what you do behind closed doors.
That's the heart of it. There's a public and private divide in Iran between, you know, who you can be in and how you can behave inside as opposed to outside in public.
And how do most people respond to that divide?
It's something that especially young people, it's all they've known. And so they've become very accustomed to having this double life. I think it takes a psychological and an emotional toll, and it's very hard on young people because I think it's hard to sort of craft an identity when you're not quite sure, you know, who you are. And that's why when there are politicians in power or moderates who try and sort of ease this divide and allow young people to behave in public the way that they do in private, that's something that young people are very eager for, that they can be honest and be themselves outside and not live in this sort of split world.
Now, the other big piece of your book, Honeymoon in Tehran, is how you met a man in Tehran, how you fell in love and moved in together and discovered that you were pregnant. That's a pretty dicey situation, isn't it?
It could have been, and I was very worried that it would be. But I was very surprised by people's reactions. You know, along the way, if you're a pregnant woman, you have to disclose that at different instances. And I found people very understanding and relaxed about it and not at all judgmental. And even people in positions of authority when we were getting our marriage license, for example, and I had to tell people. It was just really reflective, I think, of how secular and liberal Iranians have become socially and culturally, sort of in contrast to their government.
That's so interesting, because certainly that's not the image that we have here, that there is this large secular strain within the country.
I do think that that's one of the ways in which Iran is really still misunderstood. It's certainly a nation in which the majority have a secular attitude toward politics. They're very open to the West. They've come to be very modern.
You write about how you, as at one point at least, as an unmarried pregnant woman, were careful about concealing this news. And what potentially were the dangers?
Well, for example, premarital sex can be punished by flogging and heavy fines. You know, that is the worst case scenario.
Does that actually happen much?
Very rarely. But you never know, and I think that the anxiety is something that young people always have to live with, and I think that it makes them very stressed, and there are high rates of depression and suicide in Iran, and I think that reflects just the anxiety of not knowing, you know, might this happen to me one time?
Now, you ended up getting married. Why did you and your husband and your young son end up leaving Iran?
Well, we had started to think about leaving once we had a child, because raising a family, raising children in Iran is very challenging. You know, I've had friends who are raising children, and it's sort of a constant battle with, you know, the government and their teachers at school, who very much still, you know, are forced to teach very ideological, religious things to children. And your kid comes back home from school and says, well, Mommy, you're immoral because you don't wear a veil, you know, in front of my uncle, you know, things like this. And you're competing, I think, all the time, you know, in teaching values to your children. And it was not something that we wanted to have to do. And Iran had taken a very dark turn under Ahmadinejad. So we just decided in time that, you know, we thought that we would raise a family elsewhere.
Azadeh Moveni now lives with her family in London. She talked with Steve Paulson about her book, Honeymoon in Tehran. Now that's something no one's heard since the Iranian Revolution, the sounds of women cheering at a soccer match. Recently, the Iranian women's national football team played its first soccer game in decades. For years, the team was tolerated by the government but could practice only indoors. No one was allowed to watch them. But all that changed when a small women's soccer club from Berlin took on the system. German filmmaker David Assmann followed these women through the red tape to their soccer match with a camera in hand. The result is his documentary, Football Undercover. He says just trying to figure out how to get started almost did them in.
There was no path for us to go. We had to find the way ourselves, and we figured it would be fairly easy. But as soon as we started working on this project, everything seemed to be working against us. Like, the election of Ahmadinejad happened like 2 or 3 months into the project, and we knew that was not going to be a good thing for us. And then the nuclear things and ultimatums ending all of the time, and the situation was really getting kind of tense.
This is part of the film, in fact, that there was worry whether the project could go forward given the change in politics in Iran.
That's right. The project turned out to be much more difficult than we expected. But of course, for the film, it's good because we have a lot more drama than we expected.
What about for the women on the German team? They must have had mixed feelings at best about whether they wanted to go to Iran where all of this was happening, didn't they?
Well, when we started with the project, they didn't have a clear, or most of them probably didn't even have a vague idea about Iran. And my sisters and I really didn't know much about Iran either. So that was a good thing, for one, because we were going to be very unbiased and open-minded about it. But of course, as the political situation got worse, the Berlin players had their second thoughts.
Maybe it was good that you didn't know very much because you were not daunted by what would otherwise have perhaps been scary.
Yes, that's right.
Now, did the German women have to make compromises in their style of play, in their apparel, in their personal lives in order to make this trip?
Of course, if you go to Iran, you have to play by their rules. And for women, these rules consist of wearing the hijab and long sleeves and trousers, even when you're playing soccer. So when we started this project, of course, we were trying to have like the best circumstances for the match, like, having the players play unveiled and having a mixed audience, like men and women in the stadium. But it was pretty sure clear from the very beginning that we would have to make some compromises to get anywhere at all. So, yeah, that's what we had to agree on.
There's a great scene on the plane with the German women trying on the headdress for the first time. There's one who says of another, "You look like my mother." That's not a fashion statement that many Western women would want to make.
Yeah, I'm glad you liked the scene, because I think it's pretty important to see that. Because these girls in the team that are laughing in this scene and seem to have quite a problem with putting on the scarf, they have Muslim backgrounds. So for the non-Muslim players in the team, putting on the headscarf was no big deal at all. It's like putting on a costume to comply to the rules in Iran. But for those women who had to make an active choice against wearing the headscarf, probably against the family's tradition even, for those it was a much bigger deal, actually.
So, the essence is that you were able to have the match, but it wasn't, I gather, a match quite in the way that it would be in Germany. You could play, but they had to play with headscarves. They had to play with uniforms with long sleeves and trousers.
Yeah.
Things that the Iranian team, I suppose, would find quite normal.
Well, maybe not quite normal, because it was their first match too, but... Yeah, it was a very interesting situation, in a good way and in a bad way as well. The Iranian team was kind of annoyed of having to play in front of an all-female audience, because they said we're wearing hijabs and headscarves.
So no men were even allowed in
to watch them? No, I had to stay outside.
You couldn't go in?
Yeah, Ayat and I and our cameraman and the president of the Berlin Club, we had to wait outside and just
all
heard
this work
the
you'd put in
atmosphere.
And you experienced some of the same thing the women do the rest of the time.
Exactly. It was like exactly the reverse reality that time. The Berlin team actually welcomed this experience of playing in front of a female audience, because they thought this is kind of like a niche that the women have like conquered for themselves. So they thought it was quite nice to have this situation. And also for the women in the stadium, it was a first time experience too, as they are not allowed to go to men's soccer matches in Iran. So they wanted to show that they know how to behave in the stadium and they know all the songs and so on. So they were providing perfect atmosphere from the very beginning to the end.
Well, and the government again gave you permission to do this, but then insisted on these rules. And if I interpreted it correctly, that row of women in the black chandra, is that what it's called?
Chador
is called.
Mm-hmm.
They looked in Western terms like nuns who were very unhappy with the behavior of the women behind them. It looked like they were writing down who was behaving badly in the crowd.
Yes, but as far as we heard, there were no consequences for the women in the stadium at that point. Of course, later we had some contact to female rights activists who were at that match, and they were arrested for other things, so it's very dangerous all of the time. But this match didn't have any consequences for them.
Now, you do have footage of the match, and had you taken women along to film?
Yeah, we had a male and a female photographer from Berlin, so the guy had to wait outside with Ayat and me. And Anna, our female photographer, was inside, and we reinforced her with 3 Tehran-based camera women for that special occasion.
Part of this must have been difficult to film, because you were filming the Iranian women doing something that their government has questions about, to say the least. They took some chances to do this. In fact, there's one young woman who didn't end up playing on the team who at one point confesses that she occasionally dresses as a boy in order to be able to go out and play, and feels that she can get away with it. It's a scary thing for her to admit on film, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very scary thing and a very brave thing of her to do that. Before shooting, we had a discussion with our Iranian protagonist about how they want to present themselves and if they want to wear headscarves for the camera or not. And Niloufar, the girl you just referred to, she said she wouldn't wear a headscarf for the camera at all. She totally objects to it and she wanted to be as natural as possible. And of course, we as filmmakers absolutely embraced that. That's what we wanted to have. As a natural picture from Iran was exactly the thing we wanted to capture.
But you had some fear for her too.
Yes, but after she told us she goes to the park dressed as a boy and plays there, we asked her if it would be okay for her to have this scene in the film, and she said, yeah, absolutely, let's do that. And of course, that was also a dangerous thing to film, because if she is discovered doing that, this would definitely have some consequences for her.
Are you able to show this film in Iran?
No, this was one of the conditions we had to meet in order to get shooting permissions in Iran. We had to tell them, we had to promise not to show the film in Iran. And, well, I don't know, there's an election coming up in the summer, and if that goes surprisingly well, maybe we have a chance of presenting the film in Iran, which would be fantastic, because we want Iranians to know about their national team, and so far only people outside of Iran could see the film. So that's sad.
David Usman is the co-director of the documentary Football Undercover. In case you're wondering, Germany took an early two-goal lead, but the Iranian team came back to end the match with a 2-2 draw. Since the film was made, the Iranian national women's football team has competed in the Women's Asian Cup, and they've started an Iranian women's football league. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard or find out more about the music or film clips, visit our website at ttbook.org or find our fan page on Facebook. Coming up, why Barack Obama needs better relations with Iran. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. A few years ago, Azar Nafisi created an international sensation with her best-selling book Reading Lolita in Tehran. Now she's written a new book, a memoir, called Things I've Been Silent About. Here's an excerpt.
Most men cheat on their wives to have mistresses. My father cheated on my mother to have a happy family life. I felt sorry for him, and in one sense took it upon myself to fill the empty spaces in his life. I collected his poems, listened to his woes, and helped him choose appropriate gifts, first for my mother and then for the women he fell in love with. He later claimed that most of his relations with these other women were not sexual, that what he yearned for was the feeling they gave him of warmth and approval. Approval. My parents taught me how deadly that desire could be. As a family, we were fond of telling stories. My father left behind a published memoir and a far more interesting unpublished one. Mother did not write, but she told us stories from her past, usually ending them by saying, "But I never said a word. I kept silent." She genuinely believed that she never talked about her personal life, although in her own way, she often spoke, it seemed, about little else. She would not have approved of my writing a memoir, especially a family memoir. It is such a strong part of Iranian culture to never reveal private matters. We don't air our dirty laundry in public, as mother would say. I no longer believe that we can keep silent. When my mother was very ill, a few years after my family and I had left Tehran for the United States, I was told that for many days she had refused to go to the hospital unless the lock to her apartment was changed. That man and his floozy would break in just as they had done before, she muttered, and loot what was left of her possessions. That man and his floozy were my father and his second wife, whom she blamed for all of her misfortunes, including the mysterious disappearance of her collection of gold coins and two trunks of silver. No one, of course, believed her. Ultimately, not one of us was able to step out of her invented world. She demanded that we remain faithful not to her, but to her story. Perhaps the most common of all narratives is one about absent parents and the urgent need to fill in the void created by their death. The process does not lead to closure, at least not for me, but to understanding. It is an understanding that does not necessarily bring with it peace, but perhaps a sense that this narrative might be the only way through which we can acknowledge our parents and in some form bring them back to life, now that we are free at last to shape the boundaries of our own story.
That's Azar Nafisi, reading from her memoir, Things I've Been Silent About. There are many reasons for lingering hostility between Iran and the United States. For instance, there's Iran's support for Hamas and Hezbollah, which the U.S. calls terrorist organizations, as well as Iran's apparent interest in acquiring nuclear weapons. On the other side, American economic sanctions have squeezed Iran, and the U.S. sponsors a covert program to destabilize the Iranian government. But President Obama says it's time for a change.
I would like to speak clearly to Iran's leaders. We have serious differences that have grown over time. My administration is now committed to diplomacy that addresses the full range of issues before us and to pursuing constructive ties among the United States, Iran, and the international community.
Historian Juan Cole supports Obama's effort to engage Iran. Cole's a prominent blogger on Middle Eastern issues, and he's written a book called Engaging the Muslim World. He told Steve Paulson that Obama has good reasons for reaching out to Iran.
I think that the Obama administration desperately needs to bring Iran in from the cold. Getting out of Iraq cleanly and succeeding in Afghanistan both depend heavily on better relations between the United States and Iran.
Why? Why does the United States need Iran so much?
Iran is enormously influential with the Iraqi Shiites. And in order for the U.S. to get out of Iraq, it needs the Shiite South to be quiet. It needs a reconciliation process between Sunnis and Shiites in Iraq. It needs reconciliation between the Arabs and the Kurds. And the Iranians are influential with the Shiites. They're influential with the Kurds. They can lubricate the reconciliation process if they choose. They can also play the spoiler if they choose. So for things to go well in Iraq for the Obama administration requires that they be on the same page with the Iranians.
Does the U.S. need Iran more than Iran needs the U.S.?
I would say that there are important trade-offs on each side, that there's a lot to gain on both sides. With regard to Afghanistan, sure, NATO and the U.S. have a real logistical problem in Afghanistan. It's how to resupply the some 70,000 troops that they now have there. And they're sending in more. The supply route had been largely the Pakistani port of Karachi up through the Khyber Pass into Afghanistan. But that route is increasingly blocked by the Pakistani Taliban. The Kyrgyzstan airport was being used for some resupply. That's now been closed to the U.S. for military purposes. There are only really two other possible routes into Afghanistan, which is a landlocked country. One is, you could offload in Lithuania and transshipped the goods by rail down to Uzbekistan and thence to Afghanistan, in which case you become very much beholden to Putin and the Russians. And the other possibility is to go through Iran, which I think some of the European NATO countries are thinking seriously about.
That's hard to believe, though, that Iran would ever allow U.S. troops to pass through its territory.
Yeah, it's not troops that...
Okay, even American supplies to fight an American war.
Well, if it's configured as an American war, sure. But it should be remembered that Iran is very threatened by the Taliban and would not want the Taliban to be resurgent in an important way in Afghanistan. In fact, in 1998, Iran and the Taliban almost went to war with one another because the Taliban killed a number of Iranian agents in the northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif. So if you configured it as, you know, a government in Kabul that's friendly to Iran, which the current one is, being threatened by an overthrow by very hardline anti-Shiite Sunnis who've engaged in massacres of Shiites, then who knows? The Iranians might be willing to play ball. The other thing is the U.S. and the U.N. now have very tight sanctions on Iran. From the American side, a company can't invest more than $20 million in Iran without attracting sanctions from the U.S. Department of Justice and risking being excluded from the U.S. market, which is among the biggest markets in the world. So it would be in Iran's benefit in a big way if it could get those sanctions lifted.
Is there talk among American leaders to lift those sanctions?
I think it depends on a number of factors. If Iran could be induced to suspend its nuclear enrichment program, I'd make a grand bargain. I'd say, look, you know, there are only two reasons for having a nuclear enrichment program. One is for energy, that they want the reactors. The other is so that they could be very near, at least, to assembling a bomb for self-protection. If the issue is self-protection, then why not give them an international guarantee backed by Russia, China, the UN, and so forth, that the regime won't be overthrown by a covert ops or by an invasion, and get rid of this congressional program we now have, which dedicates some $70 million a year to overthrowing the Iranian government. That is to say, if the problem is security, so guarantee them their security. If the problem is energy, well, they'd be much better off letting the international energy majors in to develop their natural gas, of which they have possibly 750 trillion cubic feet. I mean, they're probably one of the largest natural gas reserves in the world, and that can't be developed as long as these sanctions are on. So I think it would be possible to trade horses with them. And of course, the other key to this would be some progress on the Arab-Israeli peace process and some feeling on Iran's part that it can at least have a cold peace with Israel.
Now, there is another factor. Iran's president, Ahmadinejad, who has a penchant for saying outrageous things and pretty much everyone in the United States hates him, at least on the political level. How big an obstacle is he?
Ahmadinejad is largely irrelevant in my view. You know, the Iranian president is simply not very powerful. He's like the old pre-Cheney U.S. vice presidents. The commander-in-chief of the armed forces, the head of the intelligence, the person who makes the important decisions is Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. It is, after all, a theocracy, as we keep saying. And Ahmadinejad is not a cleric. He's a civil engineer, actually.
Do you think this hostile relationship between Iran and the United States, really for the last 30 years, has that mainly served the interests of hardliners in both countries?
Sure. I mean, politics is partly about demonizing foreign enemies, and the Iranian elite clearly uses anti-Americanism for its purposes, although, you know, it is a coin of diminishing value in Iran. Opinion polling, all of the indications are that the Iranian public really likes the United States. And so it's a relatively small sector of the public that responds favorably to America bashing anymore. And I think it is also a diminishing coin in the United States where, you know, surely we have bigger problems in the world than Iran.
But you do suggest in your book that Americans, and we're not just talking about politicians, but Americans in general need to overcome what you call Islam anxiety.
Yes, I really think that the problem is a matter of exaggeration. And I have no brief for Islamic fundamentalism. In fact, I've had guns pointed at me by Muslim fundamentalists, and I don't like it. Nevertheless, I think we have to understand exactly what it is. And there's a difference between terrorism and political Islam. And most of the politics that goes on in Iran nowadays is nonviolent. It's not a matter of terrorism or blowing things up. To that extent, I think we have to be fair in our judgment of the system. For instance, the presidential elections are skewed because there's a vetting process. Not everybody can run for president. Women can't run, and people who are too liberal can't run, and so forth. But once the candidates are vetted, that they're loyal to the regime, then all bets are off, and surprises often happen. So that indicates to me that it's a fairly free and open process.
You're really suggesting that this is a remarkable moment, a historical opportunity to repair relations between the U.S. and Iran. I mean, there's an opening, especially with President Obama now in office. And let's just speculate for a moment. Suppose they could repair this relationship. Suppose American sanctions were lifted against Iran and they were, you know, more or less allies. How would that change the situation in the Middle East?
Oh, it would change everything. It would make the situation in the Middle East much better. I mean, there is a kind of Cold War between some of the Arab states like Egypt and Jordan, to some extent Saudi Arabia on the one side and Iran on the other, in part because Iran, we don't think about it this way, but Iran is a republic, and it's hostile to monarchy, and it is also a revolutionary republic. So it is viewed, you know, by the rest of the Middle East often in a way similar to the way the crowned heads of Europe viewed the French Revolution, as dangerous and endangering to their regimes.
It's kind of ironic to think of Iran as kind of the democratic alternative to these various American allies.
It is, though. I mean, if you compare Iran to Saudi Arabia, I want to tell you there's no elected president in Saudi Arabia. So, in fact, Khomeini, the leader of the Iranian Revolution in 1979, said there's no place for monarchy in Islam. And the Gulf monarchies, the Sunni monarchies, Morocco and Jordan and Saudi Arabia, are very fearful that this idea of Islamic republicanism will jump over from Shiite Islam to Sunni Islam and endanger their crowned heads.
Juan Cole is a historian at the University of Michigan and the author of the book Engaging the Muslim World. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Iran After the Revolution, number 419A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Steve Paulson and Charles Monroe Kane, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Anne Strainchamps. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.